what I see starting to happen very slowly is much more around equality and equity, which are obviously slightly different, as well as diversity and inclusion. And those are the areas that I think, no matter how much technology we have, if we're not tackling those areas, then we're not making progress.
Stephen Ramage is my guest on this episode of Inside Ideas, brought to you by 1.5 Media, Innovators Magazine, and the Alohas Regenerative Foundation. Stephen's lowest grade, and I'm not sure if I should say a C, at school was geography, but he has been working in the geospatial sector and evangelizing location as the third global currency alongside time and money for the last two decades. Stephen started studying French, German, Russian, and Spanish in the 80s, but moved to commerce and information systems because his grandfather, who supported him through university, didn't think languages would be useful. Today, Stephen works in 3 to 4 languages most weeks, but his background in computing and information systems has served him well. He works extensively on collective intelligence in an intergovernmental partnership spanning more than 100 countries and probably close to 1,000 organizations with countless individual contributors. He believes in the words of Margaret Mead about the power of individuals and has been promoting the concept of interoperability for over a decade. Stephen would like organizations to think more about behavior, incentives, and motivation as they develop data strategies and work towards access and sharing of data to address key global challenges. But he knows and understands that the data is meaningless without buy-in and use. Stephen was part of a management buyout, has created a government startup, been on the board of an industry startup, and has been in numerous leadership positions. He was a fellow of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, is a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and was recently invited to be a fellow of the World Economic Forum. He's a visiting professor at the Institute for Future Cities at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, and an advisor to the UK Space Agency. He's an avid storyteller and keeps thinking about writing a book. He's also mentored 100 plus younger professionals, women's in the geospatial sector. He's also a friend of mine, and we've worked on many things. Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, thank you. You missed one word in my profile, which was human interoperability, because everyone talks about interoperability, and it's the human interoperability that I'm interested in.
That's so great. And I'm glad you, in reality, your biography is a lot longer. It's always like, okay, do we read the whole thing? Do we do it? But you're as old as I am. We're the same birth year. And so you've been around the block. You've been doing this for a while. Really, that's a lot of experience, a lot of connections, and we know each other really from the United Nations Resilience Frontiers a little bit. We've seen each other in other projects and friends like the UN EPDP Codes Project, Coalition for Digital Environmental Sustainability, and just different communities. We're also both at the World Economic Forum, and so obviously that's a place, and hope to see you in person in May at the annual meeting in Davos. A lot of interesting things going on, and the biggest one is really you're connected to everyone and anyone. I mean, you've worked with people, you're still working with people, and it's just like this spider web of network of people you're connected to, good, bad, and ugly, just working on making this world better or giving them the knowledge to make it better. And so I thank you for that, but that's given you so much, wisdom, I would say, to see how the world works. Do you feel the same, or is that, do you take it in a different way? Is it?
It's this whole thing, like the more I learn, the less I know, and it's funny because even although that's the case, and I know it's the same for you, because every time I see a podcast, it's someone new and they've got a book and you've read the book, and I feel the same. It's like I now have this like quest for knowledge. And so, like, you know, I have these are the books sitting at the side of my at the side of me, and I sort of, I've got five or six books on the go all the time. And I think when you get the sort of like you get into one topic, you know, and then you're like, oh, I've got to learn about that, and then that leads to another topic, and then I'm like, oh, how does that go back to my work? And oh, I know that person who did this, and before you know it, you're like, your mind is like exploding and expanding with all these ideas. So I don't know. I mean, I put it back to you. Do you think it's wisdom? For me, I'm not sure it's quite wisdom. I think it's maybe more just continuous learning for the moment.
You know what I think it is it's two things. One, I believe it's your expansion of collective intelligence. I think you're adding more to your library of your own individual intelligence. But then because you have this strong community and you're connected, like I said, to just innumerable amount of wonderful people, you're adding to the collective intelligence because you're kind of like sharing back and forth this network of networks, all this great information, and really doing it in a way. I mean, I see it as we're differentiated from other species, even though we're an animal ourselves, that we have this collective intelligence that we can pass on through books and videos and discussions and interaction with one another, that always takes humanity a step further or higher on our journey to keep up to speed with our exponentially growing world. So that, you know, where humanity is part of this ecosystem and really doing that. And so I kind of see it in both different ways. And I know you've mentioned these things before. Do you tend to agree, or do you think it's different?
I don't know. I mean, I get surrounded by teenagers because I have a teenage son, and I watch the way that they deal with the world and how they approach it. And there's this kind of like just peripheral surface level on everything. And I find a lot of people are like that. Like maybe it's because of like the Twitter effect or LinkedIn or these, you know, and fake information and whatever else. I find that the level of knowledge people have in a lot of areas is kind of superficial, and they think that that's enough. And so they like to talk about things that they think they know about, but they actually don't have that much deep knowledge. And the converse I find is true when you get these deep experts who know stuff inside out. People don't seem to really go to them or trust them for their expertise, you know, but these are people who've spent their entire careers working in these areas. So I find there's a bit of a dichotomy there. And I don't really know how that gets changed, because the amount of information, I mean, I even showed it myself. I'm trying to read five or six books and I have like 300 tabs open on every device, you know. So I'm not sure if we all, I mean, I'm actually off Twitter at the moment. I'm detoxing, kind of for that reason. I just decided to step back because my brain was exploding with information, and you know, it wasn't making me particularly productive. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but
no, I think you have.
Parsing of the information is really hard for everyone, and we're not sure how to really what's important. What's the information that we should really dive deep in, and what really matters to us?
Yeah, what I hear out of that, and you can disagree or concur either way, is that one, that these experts are really also kind of in their own bubbles, their own silos, kind of they've been in that. And so they might not be able to relate, and the outside world might not be able to relate with their expertise. And there's also not that good blend of explaining a crossover of that information. And then it's really this, what kind of collective intelligence do we pass on? What kind that do we use for our own self to gain our own knowledge and wisdom? Because a lot of this stuff it's not taught in school. It's hard to find out there sometime. There's a lot of information overload. There's a lot of documents all over. And don't be afraid. I know you're with an intergovernmental agency, and so we're not going to get political or bureaucratic or any kind of get into any drama that's going on in the world. But really, it's hard to sift through some of the media and information that we're receiving to kind of fine tune where do we need to go as humanity and to move us forward.
I mean, I went to a meeting yesterday for the IPCC, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and almost what you described happened. So we have these experts who have, you know, thousands of these experts have got together, the scientists, and they've put together the guidance, you know, around what's happening with adaptation, mitigation. They put together these summaries for policymakers and everything. And everybody says, we need to act now, we need action, now's the time to deliver. And then they probably all just go back to whatever they're doing. And, you know, and that's the thing that kind of drives me mad is, like, you know, all these people who say, oh, we got 5 million views on our podcast. Well, you know, great. But what action did that result in? And one guy, it was a physicist from CERN, he said, look, I'm a scientist, but I don't understand all the stuff you've put in this report. You know, how do you explain this to people who are like my mother or my sister or people who are never going to read a report? And I don't think the answer was particularly forthcoming. I think, you know, there's still a big gulf between the amazing work, don't get me wrong, I really, really admire, and I think it's important, the work that IPCC does, and the huge effort put in by all these scientists and the people who are helping to sort of translate some of that stuff into the policymaker activity and the summary for policymakers that I mentioned. But I still think there's this massive gulf to get that to the sort of like the people who don't understand the terminology. And, you know, like you said at the beginning, you and I are the same age. And I feel like right now I'm 50, 51 soon. And I'm hoping to work for another 20 years, maybe 25 years. And so where do I put my energy for that next quarter of a century? These are the sort of existential thoughts that I have. And so when I go to these kind of meetings and I hear that, it makes me wonder, do I need to pivot and do something else, you know, rather than where I sit currently?
So as well as you reading a lot of books, you know, I read a lot of books as well. And I don't know if you've seen this one or not. It's Terra Incognita.
No, but it looks like something I should read.
Yeah, it's pretty biblical. It's 100 maps to survive the next 100 years, which is interesting. And then another one is from Dr. Parag Khanna. I've had him on the podcast a couple of times. He just came out with a new book, Move, and his books before were cartography and kind of about these satellite maps of the way the world kind of really is working, even though we think it's divided up different on geography and different things. I'm fascinated by this because I'm also of the belief that had it not been for the latest computing power, innovation, visions, and dreams to send us to the moon, to get us to outer space, we really would be in the dark about a lot of things that's going on our planet and have this kind of this earth shot and this cosmic perspective, this overview effect. And so that innovation is a tickling and a hint of how our world's working and functioning. And what you do at GEO is really tied and connected to that. Can you tell us if you agree with that, that even though it's innovation, which for a lot of people is really kind of a mystery, you know, what does coding mean and how do we, what about satellites and all this, you know, we want to go to other planets. How do you make sense of that? And how do you, when you're evangelizing or connecting these people, and especially with GEO going around the world, kind of discussing this, how do you harness that and bring that together to give people that collective intelligence or understanding what the potential is on those things?
I think a lot of it comes from what we describe as openness. So we would start with something like open innovation. And the reason it's open is because it's participatory. So we're all about collaboration. And that's what I've learned, you know, that's where how I've worked pretty much the last 20 years of my career. Is, you know, getting that those multiple inputs. And we move from sort of open innovation, and open innovation is underpinned by things like open standards. And then I had a director who worked really hard to push us towards open science. And now we have a new director. I'm on my third director, by the way. So now we're on a new director, and she wants to work on open knowledge, which is kind of the culmination of all of these under the banner of open knowledge. And so, you know, I've been working on all this stuff anyway. Maybe the moniker has changed, you know, but this is all stuff I've been doing for my entire career. And I think what I see starting to happen very slowly is much more around equality and equity, which are obviously slightly different, as well as diversity and inclusion. And those are the areas that I think, you know, no matter how much technology we have, if we're not tackling those areas, then we're not making progress. And so, you know, I heard someone, we were talking about the just transition for climate change, which is fantastic that that language is now included. And social justice, you know, if we're not thinking about that, then we're not going, I don't think we're going the right direction. And what I find is a lot of the people I work with are very much, you know, they make big statements about, well, this technology will save the planet and save, and there's like 2.9 billion people who had no access to the internet, you know, a year ago. So they're kind of out of touch with some of the practical reality on the ground, people who don't have electricity, people whose concern is the price of an egg. You know, I have people I work with in informal settlements in Kibera in Nairobi, and these are the things that they talk to me about. So there's a huge gap between what the tech community thinks it's helping versus the, some of the real issues on the ground. And I do see some organizations that absolutely get this, you know, some NGOs and organizations like UNDP and others that are on the ground, UNICEF. But when you go to like Geneva, where I'm based, or New York, I find it's just a lot of admin and bureaucracy around these organizations. So I don't know how to kind of like split up, you know, the action on the ground with the, to some extent, the necessary bureaucracy, because you have to monitor and measure how funds are being distributed and everything. This is something that really plays on my mind a lot, you know, because I sit in Geneva and I feel like I'm not really getting to the real impact on the ground. I am in my personal life because I make an effort to do that. But at a work level, I feel like we could be doing more. So I sort of warbled. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, absolutely, you answered it. And there's a couple of things that come out, and I know because I know you a little bit better than the listeners. And that is that you're really taking, you have this strong belief in diversity and open source and transparency, but more so this, how can we get communities to harness this collective intelligence, this information that's just being, you know, terabytes or more of data every single moment of the day that are being collected and harnessed. How can we use that to get us on the right side of history? How can we harness that and give it to everybody, inclusion? And we're not just talking about the Western world. And so I really get that. And I want you to talk about that more, but it really ties to our last experience was in February together at the United Nations in Bonn. We were at the Resilience Frontiers working meeting, and we had a foresight type of retreat activity where we were kind of getting into the future and foresight. And there were some really interesting things that came out there that eye-openers and discussions that we had on and offline in that meeting that really kind of moved towards this question: what does a world that works for everyone look like? And that, you know, that's one of the big questions that I really want to jump out and ask you right off the bat. For you, who are, you're very opinionated, you also have experienced a lot of things on how you think we're failing or are kind of doing things in the world. You kind of have a direction or a vision, I think, already in your mind of what we should be doing. And I believe it involves a little more action, a little less talk, and a lot less meetings. But what does a world that works for everyone look like for you?
I've learned a lot. So you know, we were with Hindu Omar, and Hindu, you know, she comes from Africa, she speaks French, and you know, that's like her third or fourth or fifth language. And you know, working with Hindu, and I work with other colleagues from the Geo-Indigenous Alliance, and what Hindu and I went and had like some, you know, like had dinner together. And I come from this little Scottish village, and it was so funny how much we had in common just around the approach of how I grew up in this village and what we did. And, you know, I mean, obviously where I grew up, it was like cold and wet and gray, and where she is grows up is like hot and pretty arid. And, you know,
she's from Chad.
Exactly. And so, you know, but we have very similar approach to life and views on things and how things could be done or should be done. And I find that quite enlightening that, you know, we come from completely different backgrounds, completely different worlds, but we have a very similar approach. And I think there are many more people around the world who are very similar. And I think part of it is around a bit of humility. And part of it is around listening to others and being willing to learn. If you remember when we had one of the exercises at Resilience Frontiers, all us Western folks were like, right, let's rank the ideas. You know, this is number one, this is number two, this is number three. And Hindu said, we don't rank ideas because it means whoever's at number four, their idea doesn't get listened to because you've already picked the top three. So let's just listen to all the ideas. And then if it is the fourth idea, it will naturally get filtered out. And so things like that, you know, and I think it's really hard for people. Like I read about people who are like, oh yeah, I just moved to, you interviewed some woman who's doing amazing stuff, but she just moved to Uruguay. Not everyone can do that. Probably 95% of the world can't do that. You know, and my comment about people not realizing who has access to the internet. And I reviewed a document yesterday, this is my life. I reviewed something that was written about, we need to give support to the indigenous community. We can lead them to do. No, that's wrong. They've been doing this stuff for hundreds of years before any of you. You know, we've interfered and disrupted what they've been doing very well and very happily, and stolen lots of their ideas and everything else. So I think it's putting yourself in the sort of the shoes of others. And even for me, like, you know, now I live here, I get paid, you know, in Geneva. And I see, like, my COVID, for example, I see what happened to my nephew. My nephew had a good job in Glasgow in Scotland. And then because of COVID, he got made redundant. And then his partner had an accident at work, and he had to take time off work, and then he couldn't walk. And then, so then suddenly they find themselves, neither of them are working, and they can't really go out. And, you know, it's this downward spiral. And I think we're always all just one step away from that situation. And if we're collectively thinking about that and helping each other, then it will make it a lot easier for us as a society. And I don't know if this is like a socialist view or a liberal view or whatever, but I do believe that actually money is really important. And I believe that making money is important, because for me, the more money I make, the more I can help others, because I can afford to give to different causes and different charities. So that reflects in everything I do, I think, which is trying to get people just to think a little bit about what other people are doing, you know, how they're approaching it, what are their struggles, what are their challenges, or what are the opportunities. I find people are really quite either lazy or selfish, I think. And I don't know, because I'm not a sociologist or even an anthropologist, but I don't know, how have we reached this stage in society today where those are some of the key characteristics of a lot of people, and they're very much tied to what people would call success, you know, because they think because they've got money, then they're sort of better than others. But I think often that's short-lived, because we all go up and down in our fortune.
If you were to give me a paragraph of answering that complex question, what does a world that works for everyone look like for you? Is it that equality for everyone, that same for everyone, regardless of being lazy? Or is it something else?
I find that, I mean, you talked about Parag, you know, and I've seen his Royal Geographic Society lectures, the RGS, and he talks about, you know, the kind of the geography of where you're born and what that means. And I can't remember if he just says, you know, it's your good or bad luck where you're born. But I think it's a bit more complex than that now, because I've chosen to be away from Scotland. This year's my 30th year away from Scotland. I left in 92. And, you know, I'm a Scotsman living in France, working in Switzerland for a global intergovernmental organization. So I'm like, in your terms, I'm a global citizen. And equity and equality are very hard, because it depends on whose perspective you're looking at. If you are in that informal settlement in Kibera, then, you know, your life view is going to be, you want to try and get stable accommodation, you want to get stable income, and you want to be able to put food on the table every day. For others, their problems are, oh, I haven't been on holiday for 6 months because of COVID and I can't travel. You know, so the problems are very different. So I don't know. I mean, COVID was probably one of the things that maybe flattened that sort of equity, equality distribution. I mean, it didn't. I mean, there were huge inequalities because of, like, who got the vaccines and who didn't. But at the same time, nobody could travel. You know, everybody had to obey the rules and you know, do whatever the legislation said. So I think it depends on your viewpoint and where you sit. And that's the part that I think is really hard, because a lot of people come in with a viewpoint they think is a world view, and it's not. It's a Western or a global North view. And I'm guilty of that. And I have to pull myself back. And I have to remember that, you know, that story about the price of an egg. I have to remember that when I'm thinking of going out to buy my next bike or, you know, my new skis or something, you know, do I really need them? Could I use that to help someone somewhere else do something else?
think it's so I know that it's important to be financially secure or to have money so that you can be charitable to others and help out in that respect. What if our models were to shift and to change where everyone had that equality of not, and I wouldn't say universal basic income, but that security of the basics, the infrastructure, the food, water, shelter, security, so that they didn't just need to worry about the basics of life, but could focus on, you know, thriving and growing and being creative and doing what their soul intended to be or to do. Do you think that would make a big difference?
Absolutely. I mean, in 2015, I worked for the World Bank in Tanzania on a water sanitation and health program, WASH, and you read all these articles about how people don't need money to be happy, and I think that's true. And that, you know, there's an amount of money that is, I think it's something like, you know, $75,000, like, people are happy. I mean, for some of the people I work with, like, they're never going to see $75,000 in a lifetime, right? And I think based on what you just said, if there's a level of income that's commensurate with the lifestyle they lead, and that lifestyle is, you know, they do have clean sanitation, they do have drinking water, they do have what we would call normal things in life, but they're luxuries, like, you know, being able to get on the internet every day without having to think about electricity and those things. Yes, I think that would be, I you know, Hans Rosling, you know, if you read Factfulness, you've probably read, you know, and you look at the work that his children have continued. I wish there were more people doing that kind of education and just explaining, you know, that some things have improved over the years, but there are still big challenges at an infrastructure level. I think now we get into this situation where people are also using things like climate change as an excuse to put off some of those investments or to defer those investments. I mean, people older, younger, wiser, than me are taking on these challenges. And this is what I feel like I should almost give up what I'm doing and somehow find a way to contribute to this, you know. And I had a big decision because I thought, you know, I really enjoyed working. It was a short-term contract, but I enjoyed what I did for the World Bank in Tanzania because you can see the change on the ground. And you know that we were mapping, there's 90,000 water points. And you know that it's women and children who are walking to collect the water. And if you can make the water points closer to where people live and it improves the distribution and the access to water, then that makes a change in people's lives. And so I really enjoyed that. And I thought that's something I want to do. And then I decided to join GEO because we're working on policy. And so if you can impact policy and you can make policy that changes hundreds of millions of lives, then surely that's a better thing. But you get wrapped up in all the politics and the bureaucracy and the language and the, so I don't know, like I can't figure out where's the best place to have the most impact. And so that's why in my personal life, I try and support some people financially in communities where I just know like life is really tough and it's not that hard for me to help them. Not just financially. I try to give some knowledge and some experience from, you know, having worked for, you know, 25, 30 years. So I don't know. I mean, your questions are.
There's no, you let me tell you, you got the answer right. there's no really right or wrong answer. And I know, because I've asked about 3,000 people that same question. And every time the answer has been different. There's only been maybe not even a handful that have been similar. Because the cultures, the community, the alignment on what people are living at the moment and what they've experienced in their life is also different. And they're also living different models. They're living different economic models. They're living different life models. You know, some are very extractive. Some are very hedonistic. Some are very capitalistic, whatever type of a life model. And some people are living like three or four different models at the same time. They work this job that's could be very capitalistic or an extractive labor type of a job. But then when they're at home, it's a total different model that they live at home. And so it's almost like these separate lives or worlds that are kind of trying to merge. And in many respects, a lot of humanity is, especially in the Western world, I feel is that their work is pulling or taking them in one direction or pushing in one direction, and their home and family life is pushing in a complete different direction. There's always this conflict. When you come before the pandemic time, when you would come home from work or on the weekends, you know, to how to make that work-life balance and that blended, you know, lifestyle. And so, you definitely answered it correctly. I'm also strongly of the belief that if one of us is suffering, whether it's a city, a country, or a person, then we all suffer unless we kind of find a way to get a balance, because eventually it affects the entire world's issue. I mean, we see the ripple effects on that in many respects. The other thing that you mentioned about geo that I really like, and I can't answer the question for you, but this is how I see it. So I see obviously the impact on policy from geo, fabulous, but I also see this infrastructure of the future being laid and being built, that if you have that influence that you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation about openness and transparency and kind of for everyone, and that that if we lay that foundation, we make sure it's accessible and available for those in the developing worlds or those who need that. I think those extra tools, and Hindu Umaru Ibrahim, who you mentioned, good friend of both of us, and we know her, but she's using that technology now. Matter of fact, she just sent me some pictures she's contributing to my book, Menu B. But in Chad, she's using geospatial data, satellite data, and information to help her pastoral community to take that indigenous wisdom and give it kind of a little superpower, because now they've got a little bit bigger picture of what's going on, which is a big help. It's really a late enabler in some respects. In some respects, it can be used for, you know, the ugly and the bad as well. But I like the opportunity that it opens up for this. And so my view is to come back and answer your question is really, I believe you're setting that infrastructure that works so that eventually the policies, the access, the data points are there, because I do believe broadband should be a human right. I believe that everybody should have these fundamental infrastructures to be able to keep up with this exponentially growing world. We need some tools as humanity to kind of understand what's going on, and we don't need it in different parts of the world. We need it wherever humanity is. So these local economies, these local technologies, and really that's available and accessible. One reason, and you know, maybe you can tell me your views or opinions about, I'm really kind of a fan of Starlink broadband, or that type of a concept, to have a kind of a global SIM, a global internet provider that kind of removes nations' borders and walls and gives accessibility to everyone, not just at high speeds, but just to get them on the information highway of good, bad, and ugly of what's going on, so to say, today, because I think it's an empower and enabler to get people on the right side of history to have those basic resources. So I really think you're rightly placed. It's nice to do those projects in Tanzania and other places and see the insights on smaller areas of the world and how that impacts. And especially if they work and you can, the communities around Tanzania, and if you keep spreading that further and say, hey, this really worked good here, can we mimic that model? Can we get, you know, help you open source and transparent to spread it? The thing in my business world or in my world of dealing with a lot of businesses, let's say Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Unilever, or I deal a lot with food companies or even energy companies, they do these, what they call projects that have to do with renewables or have to do with new technologies. And they get grants and subsidies for that. And they say, wow, this really worked. This was so successful. But then you're like, well, why don't you implement that at all of your 900 other facilities and do it? Instead, they just say, oh yeah, it was a great project, made money and was successful. That was it. They got the grants and the subsidies and then they walk away. And so I just like, why aren't we implementing some of these things worldwide? And that's kind of my focus.
Yeah, I mean, you raised a lot of points there. I mean, I remember when I first started in what's called the sort of the geospatial sector. And everybody kept saying, you know, we need to get outside and talk to others outside our community. But they were still saying that to the people inside their community. So when I joined GEO, I went to the World Economic Forum. And I know there's a lot of views, and I think a lot of them are misunderstood as well. And the reason I went to the World Economic Forum is because it's business leaders and it's world leaders, it's presidents and prime ministers. And so I went from maybe being able to get coverage from 50,000 or 100,000 readers in some publications, or even, you know, a million across Twitter, to 20, 30, 40 million. And so I think that's part of it is, that reach and that ability, like you were saying, to sort of take good practice and spread it out. And because we are competing on a knowledge base today, then you need to somehow stand out, or you need to have a message that resonates with people. And so for me, I think that's maybe why I feel like the geospatial sector is now mature, even although people keep saying we need to step outside. The range of applications and the places where geospatial data tools, technology, services are being used is pretty much everywhere in the world. It can obviously always continue and grow, but the penetration has definitely, you know, increased dramatically since I started. And there's a lot of new younger commentators coming in, and you know, it's like the cyclical stuff. You know, like I made the point of using the term human interoperability because I've listened to the term interoperability now for three cycles. I'm in my third cycle, you know, and I've got all these younger people coming through who think that we've never thought about all the things they're thinking about now. And I did the same myself, you know. You come in and you see a problem and you think, oh, I know that, I have got an idea for a solution for that. But the people who are before you are like, yeah, we've tried that too. And, you know, we went down this path and this didn't work, etc. So I guess what is good with GEO is that we have over, you know, there's over 100 countries. And within each country, there are a number of different agencies, you know, trying that sort of interagency collaboration is a big drive for GEO. So trying to get the agriculture ministry to work with the water ministry, to work with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to work with the National Statistical Office, and get them all aligned from our perspective around Earth observations. And so when I talk about Earth observations, I mean the ability to measure anything happening on land, sea, or air. So we say sensors in, on, and around the Earth. So many people think that it's just satellites, and it's not. It's much more. It could be like ground water or soil moisture or ocean salinity. Those are other measures of Earth observations. So from that perspective, the work of GEO is amazing to drive towards these big policy frameworks like the SDGs or the 2030 Agenda, the Paris Agreement, the New Urban Agenda, the Sendai Framework, the Minamata Convention. All of these areas is what we're doing. But we're still very much based on taking science and technology into policy and decisions. And then we don't really see what the decisions lead to. And I guess that's where I'm feeling like I'd like to be more aligned with the decisions and the action on the ground. But how to do that, I don't know. And maybe it's something I need to try and do more through GEO.
It's actually really rewarding to see that as well on the ground. And I know why you're really bring that up, because it's a different feeling. So sometimes when you have this bigger perspective and dealing with all these countries and intergovernmental agencies, it's hard not to be blinded by the bureaucracy or to pull all your hair out. I don't know if you pulled out your hair. I haven't yet.
I haven't got that much.
Another thing that we're talking about there is this model, these models that we're working with, and humanity has had this huge problem forever. We keep repeating the same models over and over again. I mean, we've had more than 21 different civilization collapses before in our world, you know, early antiquity, Mesopotamia, Greeks, Roman, on and on. And they were all because of environmental or ecological collapse tied to food and basic infrastructures. And then two of them were tied to displacement or disease, viruses, and conflict collapses. And really, if you look at all of them, they all ran the same model, this very hierarchy model, where there's a ruler, emperor, president, someone at top, a dictator, a lord, a king, whatever. And then at the bottom is this peasants and farmers and laborers and on the bottom, kind of holding the whole infrastructure up. And it just is one that can't sustain itself forever. It's a model that is, almost like an inverted pyramid. It's weighted in the wrong direction on the wrong people. And after these civilizations get built up, those who help build the framework, who have been beaten down and trodden and kind of, you know, the farmers, laborers, and peasants, so to say, slaves, is really those people who then, once the society's been built up to a certain level, they realize can't sustain itself, and they need to, those people need to leave or somehow go away, or there's this dis-ease, right? And so we're seeing that model repeated today all over the place. I work on several, you know, cities and organizations that are building up, and I've seen the past in different parts of the world where they haul in people from Pakistan and from China and from Korea and from India to come and build up, do the construction work and the hospitality. And then after it's built up, and I don't want to mention any names, Qatar or Dubai or anything like that, but once it's built up, then those people need to go away. They live in camps and labor pools during that time, and then they go away. That's a very similar model to those civilization frameworks. And so I would really like to know, because you talk about these boundary spanners and you talk about models that really work. And that's why I asked you that question in the beginning. What does a world that works for everyone look like? What models do you see emerging? And as this geospatial area that you've been focused in, is there a model behind that? Is it more network of networks? And can you kind of tell me a little bit what you've seen in your experience, and where do you think we need to go?
So there is, I mean, I don't think there is a world that works for everyone. I think there are many different models, and people have choice and they choose which model works best for them and their values and their lifestyle. And so I guess I should be clear that I don't think there is one single model. And the same is true for the work that we do, which is why originally there was this like global Earth observation system of systems, because there are so many different systems. So, you know, can you bring the systems together and make the best use of the best parts of the systems? That's always been my kind of approach to the systems of systems thing. And so the network of networks idea is very similar, that I can never reach personally, 195 countries of the UN. But through this network approach, then yes, I can reach a lot more than I can going one-on-one. And so I think that that approach of taking the elements of the model that work really well is a really good model. And that's something that now what we're trying to look at is, how do we, you said right at the beginning, you know, if something happens in one part of the world, it has an impact on another part of the world. And so that interconnectedness is not always reflected in what we do in the science and technology, because there are corporate motives, or because researchers are paid according, you know, they have to publish to X number of papers. So there are always these limitations on how people work and how people operate. I think what GEO does is tips that on its head. And so we bring in the private sector, and, you know, they're not allowed to own or keep the data that comes from the countries that we work with. Everything's open access. The systems are all, open, shareable knowledge, freely and openly available data, all of these things. And so I think that's what is really useful when you sit at the table. Our executive committee is 16 countries. So Senegal has a say alongside USA, you know, very different sized countries with very different budgets, but they sit at the same table. And that rotates, you know, the people who are on that table. And the same thing is true in the work program. We have like about 65 activities in the work program. And a lot of the work is driven by consensus. So, you know, you can come in from any country in the world or any type of organization, and you give your view, and then others will talk around and they'll see what's best for the community. So I really like that model and that approach, and I've done it in other communities during my career. And I think there are some of these kind of communities that have developed quite sophisticatedly, in a more sophisticated manner. I don't know the word I was trying to say, but there's organizations like the Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team. And they applied for this audacious project, and they got, well, they won't say publicly how much money they got, but I know it was quite significant because I've seen the way they've hired and grown, and they're opening offices around the world. And I think the way that they've done it, which has been very transparent and based on equity, and they publish the salary rates, they publish, you know, the criteria for the jobs, and they really try hard to follow those kind of principles. And so if that model works for you and your ethics and your morals and your outlook on life, then that's great. But I know that there's a whole bunch of other people, because I spent, you know, 15, 18 years in the private sector, they wouldn't even touch that model because they don't get it. And they're very focused on, you know, profitability and growth and, you know, all these other things, which is a very different thing. So that's why I don't think there is one single model. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not a philosopher. I probably should read more philosophy because I live in this, the town that Voltaire built. I live in Ferney Voltaire. And so there's a lot of stuff round about here on the pavement, you know, the sidewalk, with quotes from Voltaire. There's a park where we have Voltaire shows all in French every summer. So maybe I need to get a bit more into philosophical thinking, because my thinking is probably quite, I see this community here, this community here, this community there, and I don't really see much of a crossover with them. And that's where I think things like climate change can bring the communities together, because if we're all trying to address humanity at its basic level and survive, then maybe that's something that can help us all. But it needs, this is where my human interoperability comes in, because it needs us to understand, how do humans work together? You know, what are those intrinsic motives? What are the incentives for people to do this? What stops people from doing things like data sharing or collaboration or even just listening to each other? You know, and there's very little literature or anything on human interoperability. So that's something I've been trying to push. I did a blog post with the Global Partnership for Sustainable Development Data, GPSDD, last year. And we talked about, how can we drive this concept forward? How can we engage more people in doing this? So that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to push, and I'm trying to use my experience and my knowledge to get people to contribute more to that, so that overall we break down some of those barriers and we drive collaboration.
I love that. I have some other questions for you. So there's the digital ecosystem for the earth that we also kind of did with David Jensen from the UNDP as well. And has that now moved or morphed into codes, or is that a really separate thing? And how does that compare to what GEO does? I think I asked you the question once before, is there like one hub, cumulative spot of information data where all these satellites that are looking back at our earth and collecting data are put together with the sensors and information to get that information that we need to make it open source to find it? And so I'm kind of wondering, is that GEO? Is that something different? Is that an aspect in GEO, or is it another platform? Is there someone working on it?
No, it is for sure. I mean, UN Environment Program, UNEP, where David works, and we work with a lot of them, the colleagues there, on a whole range of, I've been part of the Big Data Working Group for the UN Science Policy Business Forum, along with IBM, we co-chaired that working group. And if you look at the stuff that David's been working on, then a lot of it is around the big earth data and some of those concepts. But I think they go further, because UNEP has a broader remit than GEO. And so they do look at some of the stuff around incentives and stuff and changing behavior and circular economy and, you know, the things that UNEP looks at around pollution and some of these other areas. We're kind of more laser focused on Earth observations. So if you look at, yes, you have like, you know, the NASA Landsat program, which is all about open data. It's been doing that for 15 years now. And you have the Copernicus program from the European Commission and European Space Agency and others. You can get lots of data and information. You can get guidance on how to use those data and information. You can get examples of cost-benefit analysis. All of that stuff is in there. I think what GEO is trying to do is bring everything, public and private sector and the Indigenous community and youth and others, and really find a way to make all of that as available as open knowledge, so that it does really drive the policy making, policy development in countries. We worked over the last few years on something called a knowledge hub. And so this is is described as a digital repository or like a digital library. And it's, you know, I mentioned those 65 activities. Some of those activities are really big, like, for example, GeoGLAM on global agricultural monitoring came out as a result of a mandate from the G20 ministers of agriculture more than a decade ago. And so they've been supporting and responding to that ever since. But they've had to deal with things like policy changes that came in, like through the global policy frameworks in 2015 with the, you know, the Paris Agreement and the 2030 Agenda. And so they've had to move how they respond. But they do things like crop monitoring for early warning. So they're able to provide look at the crop monitoring conditions and say, what does that mean in terms of what's going to happen to people's livelihoods or the availability of food? And you know, what's that impact? So they've been able to work on that. And so they produce papers, they produce algorithms, they produce methods, they produce the science, they produce videos, they produce all of this collateral, all of this knowledge. And so what we've done is to be able to capture all of that, it goes into the knowledge hub. We create these knowledge packages around the different areas. And so it's a very large program. You know, 65 activities is a lot because it's agriculture, biodiversity, climate, disasters, energy, forestry, land, water, ocean, urban, you know, anything you can think about, we're effectively doing with Earth observations. And so the knowledge hub is a way that anybody can access that knowledge that has been created through the work program. And at the same time, we have another 70 projects with Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Planetary Computer, and Google Earth Engine, plus an American company called ESRI, or ESRI, a European company called Synergize. You know, so we're working with all of these different entities. And so trying to capture all the outcomes is what you were saying, you know, if a Unilever or a PepsiCo or someone does something that's good, you know, why don't they take it out to other locations? Well, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to share that good practice and make everything openly and freely accessible through this knowledge hub. So that was built on top of an open source platform from CERN, you know, the particle physics people who did the Large Hadron Collider. So they, you know, they have a huge, I mean, they're managing vast swathes of data and they have a massive partner network. And so they built this, they use this thing called Invenio RDM, and we've just built on top of that. And we've now built this knowledge hub, which is becoming operational. So I think that gets closest to what you were asking about from our perspective in terms of like accessing, you know, the knowledge and data and information that's coming out of GEO.
The last few years, the big buzz has been about digital twins. Are you involved a lot in the data, the sensoring on creating digital twins? A lot of cities now are coming up with a digital twin to prepare. And actually, even just this week, the UN came out and said, you know, one of the biggest things we can do to kind of avoid a lot of death and destruction is early warning systems to get people out into other areas. And they kind of want to not only use the early detection device and sensoring in that data, but also create a digital twin so that they can find the population and the pathways and where to go and what to do.
So it's funny because you and I didn't prepare any questions. We didn't share any notes in terms of this discussion. But that's probably one of the biggest areas of my work right now. So I just reviewed a World Economic Forum document on digital twins, and it was very lopsided. And I don't think it's unfair saying that because it was an initial document, but it was a private sector. I said, no, there's a huge public sector investment in this. You know, if you look at Destination Earth that's being developed and you have digital twin activities with EU METSAT, with the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, ECMWF, with European Space Agency. They're all working on these big environmental issues. There's about 30 million euros from the European Commission looking at digital twins of the ocean. So I know digital twins from when I worked for the British government a decade ago, and we were working on things like building information models and the built environment. They were using digital twins in that environment to look at cities. And unless I'm mistaken, it's moved quite considerably in the last 3 or 4 years towards more environmental monitoring and using it from that perspective. So I think there is a massive shift in this area, and it's great to see big public sector investment going into this. I mean, obviously the private sector will create the tools and services, the data products and everything that will help, you know, broaden the reach and maybe even implement some of the ideas from the public sector. But this is massive. So that's one part to what you just said. The second part is, So the Secretary General Guterres, I don't know how to say his name, but you know who I mean. You know, he said that in the next 5 years we want to have early warning available for everyone in every country around the world, and so we've started working a lot more closely with the World Meteorological Organization WMO, where I'm actually hosted. That's where I work in that building. And the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, UNDRR, is also now in that building. So they have a center of excellence between WMO and UNDRR, and we're now part of that as well. And so that is looking exactly at this early warning, early action. We're also now a partner of something called the Risk-Informed Early Action Partnership, REAP, and also something called the Anticipation Hub, with the Red Cross and a number of other, you know, countries supporting Germany, UK, Bangladesh, you know. So yes, this early warning, early action thing is really starting to drive. And I find it intriguing, right? Because 2007, I was part of like some task forces, and we've always been talking about prevention and preparedness versus response and recovery. And we've always talked about how it's so much better for saving money. You know, the return on investment is much better doing it up front, as well as saving lives and livelihoods. So I don't understand why these things have taken so long. I mean, maybe I've missed something along the way in the last, you know, decade. But anyway, it's good. It's all happening now. There's a big movement, and everyone's like really thinking about how do we push our efforts and our investments towards this direction. And I like there are programs like CRUISE, which is also sponsored by WMO, which is actually doing funding to initiatives on the ground. And they're giving millions of dollars to do these practical initiatives around the hydrological meteorological arena to deliver against early warning and early action. So it's a fast moving area now, and there's a lot more money coming into it. And I think there's a lot more people understanding the necessity to do this, because the figures now for disasters are in the billions of dollars. And there are a lot of lives being lost. So I think that's probably one of the, I mean, I'm going to the Global Platform for Disaster Risk Reduction next month. And I think that whole early warning, early action will be a big theme across that whole event.
That's beautiful. I really hope that we get to see each other in Davos, May 22nd through the 28th, 27th, I believe is the annual meeting and the forum. I would love to invite you also as well to come by and throw in your hat in the ring a little bit and talk and educate us all about some of the things you're working on, if you can, since we'll be in the same spot again. I have a couple meetings and events going on there as well.
Do you have a caravan or a spare bed? Because I've traveled several times.
It's expensive. It's
craziness trying to find somewhere to stay.
Well, because it's in May, it's in May, so it'll be cheaper.
The last time I went to Davos, I think I spoke to one of your old bosses, Al Gore.
Yeah.
So I was chatting to Al Gore, and he got pulled away because I think the president of Japan or someone wanted to speak to him, you know. But it was great because I got to tell him that we have put into practice these digital earth programs in Geo. We have digital earth. It started with Digital Earth Australia. And then we took some of the learning and it's something called an open data cube. We took that model to Africa and we created Digital Earth Africa, which is now fully operational and is amazing. I'm on the board. I'm the only male non-African on the board, which is a great privilege. We have Digital Earth Pacific. I'm on the steering committee for that. And we have Digital Earth Americas, which is under development. So I got to say to Al Gore, you know, we're actually taking some of your concepts and the ideas and putting this into operation and developing this all around openness and transparency and accountability using Earth observations. So this is great. And if anybody's watching and they have like, I don't know, maybe $150 million, that's what we need to sort of take this stuff to the next level, to build it out and help the countries so that it becomes owned by the countries and then they can start to fund it themselves. But this is amazing. This has been an amazing journey for me personally with the Digital Earth initiatives. And I got to give a big shout out to Brian Kilo at NASA and Aditya Agrawal, who runs D4D Insights, and and Diswa Melissa from Sansa. These are some of the people that I've had the pleasure of working with and sort of developing these over the last, you know, three, 4 years.
I can tell you the money's absolutely there. It's out there. And we just need to get the information that you needed and for what you're planning it for, which is absolutely fabulous. I've almost pulled out my hair in the past before, because we've been talking about some of these things for a long time. And it's like now that we've experienced a pandemic and lockdowns and Brexits and crazy American politics and on, I could just go on with all the craziness going on, that we've been shaken awake that there are some better models out there that we should really use and for our benefit. But their models, we would say, hey, we should do this in advance, a little bit preparedness, a little bit foresight. And boy, we would have realized not only is it a better model, but it's a model that can regenerate and sustain itself over time. So it's actually, I hate to use the word profitable, because we shouldn't be profiting off of anyone or our world, but it's just a model that works a lot better if we kind of are ahead of the game. So I totally know what you mean. We're going to wrap it up fairly soon. I have four more questions for you. One of them, and this is why I asked you if you'd come to speak in Davos. It'll be different. It's a total different World Economic Forum this time around. One, it's in May, which is different, and it's there'll be less people, more apartments, more hotels, more things available. So hopefully it won't be a big thing. But they've also changed the hotel security zone and all that. So there's a lot of changes going on there as well. Some improvements, good, bad, and ugly. But you do, the reason I ask is you do a lot of paying it forward. You do a lot of mentoring, or you've started to do a lot more than you have in the past. I'd love for you to tell me about that and why and how that's going. And also, I know a lot of people that could really use your years of wisdom to get that empowerment, that one up to enable them to fulfill their dreams and vision.
So the reason I do it is I got a lot of help getting to where I am in my career, and people sort of stepped out of their own comfort zone or just made an effort to help me because we got on well or they saw some potential or whatever. And so I feel like it's sort of behoving on me to help others because, you know, it's sort of payback for the support I've had. And so I decided there's a group called Women in Geospatial, and it started as an idea by a friend, Julia, and she brought in a lot of other women who are also, you know, professional and actual friends, you know, over the years. And so I'd said, look, I've been doing some mentoring with younger professionals. I'd really like to help younger professional women who, you know, maybe they're facing a glass ceiling or misogyny or just don't have a platform to express themselves. So I wanted to just have chats, you know, around what I've done and then listen to them. So I have this kind of 45-minute formula where people come and they say, look, this is what I've done for the last 10 or 20 years, depending how old they are. This is what I'm doing now, and this is my aspiration. And the aspiration could be, I want to change jobs. It could be, I want to get more involved in a sector. It could be, how do I give back? You know, so they're very, like you speak to these people on your podcast, I speak to these younger professionals. And so now I've done, you know, it's well over 100, and it's mostly young women, because what's happened is this Women in Geospatial Network, someone went on to like a chat, you know, a Slack group, and they said, oh, I had a chat with Stephen and he's willing to talk to others. And then I spoke to them and then they spoke to others. And so it's had this kind of rolling stone effect. And so it's been great. And I have learned so much, so much. And there's just the thing that maybe isn't surprising to younger women, but certainly was to me, is this kind of like lack of confidence. You know, I speak to women who have 2 degrees, a master's, a PhD, and 10 years experience, and they're like, yeah, I'm not sure I'm qualified to do this. And I'm like, oh man. And like, I have to explain to them why they're so qualified, so good, so competent, and really just explain to them that they really are brilliant. And so that has been good. And I've seen people go away from it kind of really pumped. And then they've come back to me with like, look, this is my letter of application for a job. Can you review it? This is my CV. I don't really like doing that because that takes a huge amount of time. And I don't have that much time. But I've been able to introduce people who have got job interviews, you know. And the good thing, Mark, about you and I being older, I'm not saying old, but older, is that a lot of the people I know now are like CEOs, or they're like running NASA Earth Sciences, or, you know, I got a lot of very senior level contacts and they're just friends. So it's easy for me to say, hey, look, can you just give this person 20 minutes of your time, or get the right person in your team to help them? And that's something that can mean the world of difference for someone else. But, you know, for me, it's no big shakes. And so I always say at the end of the call, look, if you've enjoyed the call, if it's been useful, just let someone else know. That's the only thing I ask. And it's great, no, because, like I say, I'm learning so much, and there are so many brilliant young people. And that's what gives me hope, you know, because they are really tackling the big issues and they have no baggage, you know. Like I was saying, I've gone through three cycles of interoperability, and I'm kind of fed up listening to it, you know, because everyone means something different by it. But they don't have that baggage. So they've got energy, they've got knowledge, they've got enthusiasm, you know. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to do, is just, and also like I have reviewed thousands of CVs, and I know, you know, a good cover letter, I know how to respond to a job ad, so I can give them those kind of tips as well. So it's a bit of like, I almost feel like a little bit like a big brother to a lot of them, you know, the way I'm giving advice. And sometimes, you know, so I remember some of them called me uncle. I'm not quite ready to be uncle because, like, I keep thinking I'm younger than I am. But no, I really love it. And I think it's been useful and helpful for them.
Some of that's a cultural thing. I think I've been called uncle as well. And then brother a lot, things like that. So now I'm a grandpa now. I'm a 5-time grandpa. I was just in the U.S. and January 15th, my middle daughter, she actually had her very first baby. It's wonderful. I'm totally in love. That's all awesome. Over again with yeah. this little guy. He's so cute. But yeah, I do that, this mentoring, this pay it forward a lot as well. And it just comes back tenfold. I promise you, don't ever stop. It's such a beautiful thing. My group is not a lot of PhDs and masters or anything like that, but it's those who are just starting out on this journey to get into the academic world, to get into their new schooling, what will they learn, and discovering where to do that. It's the Aurora Fellows. And I've also done quite a few, and I'll tell you what, the ripple effect of them going back of good meetings and saying, oh man, I had this talk with Mark, it just blew my mind. Now, I was recently in, trying to think where it was. It was in Bonn. In February in Bonn, I had an Italian Aurora student who was there, and she said, hey, I heard you're in Bonn doing this foresight and this working meeting. I'm here, and can we meet? I just appreciated your thing. It was a fabulous, fabulous experience. So, and I've had that happen several times. So, yeah, it's well worth it. And it never disappoints, especially when there's no ulterior motive that you're not, you know, let me charge you for that, or my time's valuable, or whatever. Yeah. You just make a friendship and give them.
But that's what people find strange. People expect me to charge money, and I'm like, no. But that's why I'm very strict on the 45 minutes as well.
But it's always come back tenfold. I mean, for me and for them, it's just, it's so nice how it works, because the alignment and things that nobody grabbed me and mentored me, except, you know, Al Gore, of course, Bill McDonough, and many others. I've had great mentors, don't get me wrong, but really things I didn't learn in school where they says, hey, Mark, I need to tell you this, or let's talk about this, let me show you this. And and sometimes that's frustration, just to have that knowledge, how the world works, or what the models are that we're working on, and how to move forward, is a great help. Three last questions for you, or maybe two, I'll keep it to two. If there was one or two messages you could depart to my listeners as a sustainable takeaway that really had the power to change their life, impact their life, what would it be, your message?
Wow. I think for me, it's, a lot of people talk about sort of like regenerative and extractive and stuff like that. And I'm not really smart enough to get into all that stuff. I go back to just simple relationships between people. And so for me, intergenerational respect, working with people younger than you, people your age, people older than you, I think being able to see sort of issues and opportunities across the spectrum, and just being able to be have empathy. I think there's quite a lot of missing empathy, and I think if we all try to understand each other a bit more, then we'll get further. So that's there are so many people looking at donut economics and circular economy and regenerative agriculture, and you know, they just have to go back and watch past episodes of your podcast to get that kind of stuff. But I think for me, it's much more about, it's people who make or break everything. All the decisions about our planet are being made by people. Investment decisions are being made by people. How to share and access data, information, and knowledge are being made by people. And I just think having that, just taking the time to listen, actively listen to others. Don't go in and try and put your point across without actually listening to what people are saying to you before you say what you say. So I think sort of like those would be my, that those would be the things I would advocate for.
What have you experienced or learned in this professional journey of yours so far that you would have loved to know from the start? So kind of like, boy, if I'd known that. Most of my guests and even me, as I was, boy, it's about the journey. I needed that journey. But if there was something, is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what for me is seeing greatness in leaders. There's a lot of people who think they're leaders, and unfortunately they're not. A lot of what they've learned is through books, and actually they're quite the opposite of good leaders. They're anyway, I'm not going to go into that, but seeing the ones that are leaders and especially the people who are not listened to, who have good ideas, like sort of enabling them. That's something that I wish I'd learned much earlier in my career. I mean, I helped people 20 years ago. You know, there were some younger people I worked with, two women who were on reception, but they had, you know, college degrees. And I was sort of like, why are they sitting at the front desk doing something that is really not, you know, challenging them? And got them both out. And one of them was just profiled by the Royal Geographical Society. And she's now like a senior director in a major organization. And I know I had a role to play in helping her step up in her career. And the other one has become, you know, like a sort of marketing manager in a company. So that's one thing. The second thing, which is really bizarre, is like just really understanding sort of financial models and how finance really helps everything. I've always understood that, and I've been able to raise money and contribute funds to things throughout my entire career. But I think only in the last couple of years, last 5 years, have I really had this complete understanding of how the whole financial system works and how it feeds in and where it feeds into my work. So that's probably been my biggest learning is the kind of the role of finance in sustainability and in sort of longevity of projects and programs, which sounds really obvious, but it hasn't been obvious for me. It's been a learning curve.
Stephen, it's been a sheer pleasure, and thank you so much for letting us all inside of your ideas. That's all my grilling and questioning for you today. It's been a sheer pleasure to see you and have you on and have this back and forth discussion. Unless there's something you didn't get to say or you would like to ask me, now's your chance. I'm finished, and I really appreciate it. I wanted to thank you.
The only thing I'd add is we're developing a community of practice for youth. So if there are some young people out there who want to find out more about what we're doing in Earth Observations and sort of come into this, you know, open participatory process, you know, then they're welcome. I can put them in touch with some of the team who are working on that.
I'm going to put your links at the bottom of the show notes and descriptions so that they can get in touch with you or find a way to get in touch with you. And I just really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to see you. Let's make it live in Davos.
Thank you. I enjoyed the chat. Thanks.